May it please the court and counsel, my name is Anne Rome. My registration number is 18963. I speak this afternoon for Robert Blanchard. Your Honors, the Rape Shield statute was created to prevent victims, or to protect, rather, victims of sexual assault from having to endure the humiliation of unfettered fishing expeditions into their past sexual conduct. But the exceptions built into the statute recognize two important constitutional facts. First, juries are the sole determiners of witness credibilities. And if jurors are to discharge their obligation, they have to be given the information that is necessary to help them do that job. Second, the right to confront and cross-examine a witness is meaningless if the evidence needed to do that is off-limits to the defense. Falsely reporting a sexual assault is not sexual conduct. So the public policy protections of 18.3.407 do not apply to evidence of that. Prior to trial in this case, defense counsel filed a motion with an affidavit describing prior false allegations of sex assault that AB, the complaining witness, had made against her father, Caleb LaRue, in 2006. Defense counsel served in an STT on the Weld County Department of Human Services and the Weld County Sheriff's Department to get the relevant records from that investigation. The trial court received those records and released three pages from the sheriff's report to the parties in preparation for the hearing. Following the hearing, after hearing testimony from Deputy Corgan Reed from the Weld County Sheriff's Department, the court denied, and from Leanne Redfern, excuse me, who was the social worker from the Weld County Department of Human Services, the court denied defense counsel's motion to admit the evidence. The evidence at the hearing was undisputed that the maker of the allegation, the utterer of the allegation, was AB. And that the allegation was false, no one disputed that. And in fact, Caleb LaRue testified that it never happened, and no one put on any evidence to the contrary. And that AB made the allegations to Deputy Corgan Reed and to Leanne Redfern. The evidence was uncontroverted, as I said, that it was AB who made the false allegations. But the court found, and this is the court's quote, that these allegations were placed in the mind of these children, and by these children, the court was referring to AB and to her younger sister, AL. These allegations were placed in the mind of these children by their mother. And the court also said these were false allegations prompted to be made by the children, by their mother, to gain advantage in a custody dispute. And you can find that at the March 26th hearing at page 41. The trial court made this finding, and here's what's especially troubling. The trial court made this finding and explicitly told the parties that I'm finding this based on the records that I didn't give to you guys. These are the records that I didn't release to you. And so it based it on information that it explicitly relied on but kept secret, so that Mr. Blanchard and his lawyers couldn't rebut it or refute it or even know about it at all. So the trial court added an additional condition onto 18.3.407. Under the trial court's test, the proponent of the evidence now has to show that the witness has a history of prior false allegations of sexual assault and that these false allegations are not prompted by anybody else. So the trial court added a completely new condition into the plain language of the statute. And there was an additional hurdle imposed of these secret reports that trial counsel isn't allowed to look at or refute or even have knowledge of. And that was the unfair setting in which trial counsel was not allowed to present evidence that under the plain language of the statute wasn't even evidence of prior sexual conduct. Rather, it was a prior false allegation of a sex assault that, according to 18.3.407, was relevant It was fair game for impeachment, and it absolutely went to the heart and soul of the defense. As defense counsel argued, it was exculpatory, it was relevant, and it went to the defense that Mr. Blanchard wanted to present at trial, that A.B., being a young child, was, like all young children, susceptible to suggestion, especially by a family member, that she had made a false accusation to law enforcement in the past, and that that was the theory of defense in this case, that she had made another false allegation to law enforcement, again at the urging of a family member, this time against Mr. Blanchard.
Ms. Rohn, let me ask you this. How does Section 19.1.307.2 impact, if at all, the argument that you're now making that defendant should have had discovery or access to these sex abuse records?
Can the court help me understand what the court's referring to?
It's under my understanding that Section 19.1.307.2 provides that only certain individuals and government agencies can have access to sex abuse records, such as the interview that we're talking about. You're talking about the interview, right? The interview by the detective with A.B.
Are you talking about Detective Corbin Reed's interview?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, that's the problem, right? First of all, because I don't know what exactly no one knows what exactly the trial court was relying on. So I'm not certain if that's what the trial court was looking at or not. Detective Corbin Reed testified about the interview. So at the hearing on 3/26 of 2010, Detective Corbin Reed testified about that interview. The records that the trial court chose to keep confidential, I'm not certain what those records were, because the trial court wouldn't divulge them. I don't know if those were social service records. I don't know if that was part of the sheriff's report. The trial court released some of the sheriff's report. Now, the Court of Appeals, has those records because I moved to supplement, and this one of the remedies that this court could impose, and it's certainly something that I'm asking for at the conclusion of this case, is a reconsideration of this court's initial ruling denying my motion for access, and perhaps granting rebriefing after granting access to the parties following this argument. Because I think it's incredibly troubling that part of the ruling given to the trial lawyers below was explicitly premised on information that was not given to the trial lawyers, but clearly the court did rely on it. But I think that because the court relied on it, any argument that the trial lawyers were not allowed to look at it has been waived. I mean, either no one's allowed to see this and so it can't play into the trial court's determination of an issue in the criminal case, or it can be looked at by the criminal lawyers, because you can't have it both ways, in other words, Your Honor. Either the trial court can't use it at all in determining the rape shield question, or if the trial court is going to look at it and determine that that's why the rape shield doesn't apply, then as a matter of due process, the trial lawyers in Mr. Blanchard's case, both the prosecution and the defense, do get to take a look at it and make arguments or rebut it or refute it and say why it does or does not apply. But as a fundamental matter, Your Honor, the motivation behind why A.B. did or did not make this allegation is not something that 18.3.407 looks at. The reason why any witness, whether the witness is of tender years or not, decides to make a false allegation, whether the witness is prompted to do so or whether the witness does so of her own accord, is not something that the General Assembly included in the list of factors the trial court should consider in determining whether or not evidence of a prior false allegation is an exception to the prohibition against the kind of evidence that 18.3.407 applies to. And that's the fundamental flaw in the trial court's analysis. And that's why the trial court erred when it decided that 183407 operated through sloop sevens. And that error became especially concerning and especially of constitutional nature when during the course of the trial, the jury heard at the prosecution's decision evidence during Detective Danny's testimony, when a videotape was played of AB's interview with Detective Danny, during which AB says, at Detective Danny's prompting, Detective Danny, an agent of the prosecution, asks AB, why did you make this allegation? Why did you come forward and report this? And AB says, because I tell people the truth. And then again, she says, I tell people the truth and I don't keep secrets. This was how the prosecution chose to try its case. The prosecution decided to put this evidence in front of the jury, knowing full well what was on this tape. Defense counsel, during its cross-examination of Detective Danny, approached the court and asked to, at that point, certainly, as a matter of impeachment and the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, now that the door had been opened, to admit at that time the evidence that, in fact, AB does not always tell the truth, and to cross-examine on this prior false allegation. And again, the trial court returned to its erroneous evidentiary ruling and its clearly erroneous interpretation of 183407 and prohibited this. And this erroneous evidentiary ruling deprived Mr. Blanchard of a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense.
Counsel, why would it have been proper to cross-examine this particular detective about the prior incident? I mean, that's how defense wanted to introduce it, through this detective who interviewed the victim in this case.
Well, actually, defense counsel just said under 608, she was raising it during Detective Danny's testimony, but she said under 608, she didn't specify which provision of 608 she was talking about. And the trial court didn't even ask for any argument from the prosecution. The trial court just cut her off and said, I don't even need to hear from the prosecution. That's not going to happen. That's never going to happen. So,
well, that's not my question. My question was, why was it even a proper objection to this witness, 608? Any 608? What would this officer have personal knowledge of that could be used to impeach that officer or AB?
I believe that trial counsel was making the objection as timely as she could. This was when it came up, sir.
It's not a timeliness question. It's a who is the proper witness question. The witness is testifying about an interview with the victim in this case.
Correct.
Okay, and the tape is played, and this statement, I always tell the truth, I'll paraphrase, comes out. And it's at that point the defense wants to get in this other information through this detective. This information meaning this information about this other report. How does it come in through this detective?
It may not. I just think the defense counsel was trying to preserve the record then and there when the shocking, completely inappropriate thing happened at the behest of the prosecution.
Well, I don't think it was. I assume defense counsel knew of the interview. Couldn't have been that much of a shock.
Well, I think it was a complete shock that the prosecution didn't redact it as the prosecution certainly should have. I think that was quite a shock.
Should have, according to who, when?
Well, according to the prosecution before it rolled that tape, it just wasn't appropriate evidence to put on.
Isn't it incumbent upon defense counsel to make an objection to evidence? It's not incumbent upon the prosecution to make it for the defense.
I think it's incumbent upon the prosecution not to knowingly introduce inadmissible evidence, Your Honor.
No. No, the prosecution gets to try to introduce whatever it wants. If the defense has an objection, it raises an objection. Otherwise, the objection is waived.
I think actually the prosecution has an absolute obligation not to knowingly introduce inadmissible evidence, Your Honor.
Why is it inadmissible? I mean, that claim is not being raised on appeal.
That's correct.
All right, so you're not claiming on appeal the evidence is inadmissible. You're claiming instead that other evidence was excluded, other impeachment evidence was excluded. I want to know what horse you're riding here. Is it inadmissible in the first place?
That wasn't raised below, so I'm not raising it as plain error, sir.
Okay.
I'd like to save my 1 second.
Time's out.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. Regarding issue number one, which is seems to be the only issue that has been raised today, the trial court's finding was that A.B., the victim, was coached by her mother in a custody battle. So the false allegation was the mother's allegation, and it was not A.B.'s, and thus it did not establish an exception to the racial statute. Basically, the trial court's finding was that it wasn't relevant to any material fact. Also,
counsel, wasn't it for the jury though to sort out who was at fault for making the false allegation? Why does the court act as kind of a fact finder there to determine whose responsibility it was?
Well, part of the reason why the court found that it was the fact finder is CRE 403, which is that argument was that the trial court denied that here's a quote, "The only thing it would probably do would be to emotionally or mentally harm the child, and I'm not going to allow that to happen." And in the reply brief, the defense found that there is no citation to that, and that was correct. So I apologize for that. But the citation is March 26, 2010. That was the transcript. See pages 49 to 50. The trial court basically found that under 403, which is the prejudice finding, that this would be harmful to the children.
Well, wouldn't any inquiry into a prior false report arguably be harmful to a child? And why would that be the test? That would just automatically exclude it all.
Well, first of all, the court found that it wasn't a prior false report. It was a false report by the mother. It had to do with a custody battle. And the custody battle was many years over. As a matter of fact, what the court found was that the father should get sole custody, and he did. So that says something about the mother's false report. And I would also like to say that there's another reason why this fails, is because under the statute, we need multiple false reports that are in fact false. And that's under the Reese case that's cited in the briefs. One false report is not a pattern, it's not a history, and here there was one report. It has to be an official report. It can't just be multiple reports to various people about one incident, and that's what this was. It was a police investigation, and that's how we determined that it's a false report or not. There's an investigation. So multiple false reports, it's not equivalent to multiple outcries to various people about one incident. And of course here it was inconclusive, but the trial court conducted a hearing. The trial court did everything it was supposed to do here. And it found that the report was false.
The fact that the report was false, though, doesn't help your position. I mean, that's what brings it under the exception, arguably. So why does it matter admissibility-wise, in the first instance, whether the impetus for the report was motive. Why isn't that to be fleshed out by the jury? Why isn't that to be, that just seems like classic kind of credibility determination. Why does the trial court get to make a credibility determination?
Because it has to do with if it's relevant to a material fact. And that's actually what the standard is.
Sure, but in making relevance determination, the court doesn't get to say, I find this witness more credible than that witness. The court just doesn't get to do that.
Does it?
I think in this particular case, the trial court does, because an in-camera review revealed that this was all about a custody battle, and the custody battle was years over.
But just because it occurred in the context of a custody battle, does it? Where is that in the statute that renders the report inadmissible?
It isn't anywhere in the statute. But what is in the statute is the trial court must find that it's relevant to a material fact. The trial court found it was not relevant to any material fact. And I can only iterate again under CRE 403, confusing the jury, relitigating the custody battle, that is something that the trial court gets to decide.
But let's say there are multiple reports. I understand your position in this case, there's only a single report. But let's say there are multiple reports by a prior trial. They come in, okay, because there are multiple reports, and whenever that happens, there's going to be some litigation over the circumstances of those prior reports, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so that can't be the test, that we're going to have to go into the circumstances of the prior reports. That just can't be the test for admissibility. Because that's always going to happen. If that were the test, none of it would ever come in.
Well, the only thing I can say to that is this court does have all of those reports under seal for your review, and this court may decide whether the trial court was correct in that finding.
With regard to that, let me say that when I asked the question earlier of Ms. Rohn, I did not mean to imply that the detective's report or the interview was the undisclosed information that the court reviewed in camera. As I sat here thinking about it, I thought to myself, I conflated those two issues when I asked that question. So I just wanted to make that clear on the record.
Thank you. Are there no further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your excellent oral arguments, and they will be helpful to the court in reaching a decision on this case. With that, counsel are excused.